Previously on Colors.
Are you from the Middle East or North Africa and live in the U.S.? Do you want a box to check on census forms? The New York Times wanted to know.
Yeah, this project lasted for over 2 years to try and get a sense of how people of MENA heritage felt about their own identity, whether or not they should have a box to check.
Karen Zrake is one of the reporters that wrote the story about the project.
What we found overwhelmingly was that people did want a chance to be represented as MENA American in official data.
And as we were completing our interview, news on this topic was happening.
The Biden administration directed federal agencies to add the MENA box.
Coming up in this episode of Colors.
I was 6 and a half when my family came to America, July 27, 1987.
Kyle Kalia Yang is a Hmong American writer. Her latest effort is a book called Where Rivers Part. And this talented author in her book talks about the transition from her home country in Laos to here.
My first understanding of this new world was that suddenly, even my mom and dad, they couldn't prepare any of us for what was to come.
That's coming up in this episode of Colors.
Simmering racial tensions.
Segregation now and tomorrow and forever.
Fighting injustice.
I have a dream.
Conflict looming.
Justice! Peace!
Brutality exposed.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
The search for solutions starts here.
From WTOP in Washington, D.C.,
this is Colors, a dialogue on race in America.
Nakashima, and I'm a third-generation Japanese-American born in Hawaii.
I'm Rick Massimo. I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm white.
My name is Tandiwe D. Watts Jones. I am Black and African-American. I live in New York.
And I'm J.J. Green. I'm Black, and this is Colors. There's a difference between a broken home, a broken family, and a family being broken away from its home. Even though both may involve separation from a place, from a location, even from people, the idea of becoming an expat or a refugee is markedly different from a family splitting up or having to leave a home to go to another home in the same place. Today, we have on this podcast a great writer, who's going to give us some ideas about how difficult it is to be a refugee or an expat and coming to the United States under certain circumstances. Kyle, Kalia Yang is our guest. Kalia, thank you so much for joining us. You have written an extraordinary book about your life. It's called Where the Rivers Part. But this is not the first book about your family. I think this is the third. If I'm correct. But I want you to tell us about these books, but also to tell us about your journey. But I'll just say this to begin with. Your family originated in Southeast Asia and came here, and it was a difficult time. And your mother, your grandmother, and your whole family has a really wonderful story of triumph and I guess tragedy as well, and challenge that they faced in order to bring your family here. So you live in St. Paul, Minneapolis now. So give us a sense of how your journey in this country started through the eyes and the words of these books.
Yes. So my first book is called The Late Homecomer. It came out when I was 27 years old. I went to college like so many children of immigrants and refugees, thinking that I would become a doctor. My older sister had won the North End Elementary School Spelling Bee in 3 years after we came to America in the third grade. So we decided as a family that she was the one who was good with words, JJ, which meant she would become our lawyer, protect the rights that we've never had enough of, By default, I would become our doctor. So I went to college to become a doctor. By my senior year, my grandmother, Julie, passed away. You know, she dropped me off at college many times. I went to Carleton College. And every time I'd say, Grandma, let's walk out of this car together. She'd say, No, Minai, when you graduate, I will walk out of this car with you. Grandma had never been to school. She didn't know how to read or write. Her biggest fear was that she would be forgotten. So my senior year, I'm dreaming about graduation. I'm dreaming about Grandma getting out of that car, the two of us holding hands, proudly walking through Carleton's campus. But my grandma takes a fall in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. I go to her and I say, Grandma, get up. And she tells me, I'm not getting up again. There were people who loved me before you. Before you, I had a mom and a dad, brothers and sisters. And while there is no Hmong land in the map of a bigger world, I'm going to climb Hmong Mountain in my heart. I'm going to swing open that door to the house of my youth, and everybody will be there. Dinner will be ready. And they would just say, why are you so late in coming home? My grandma looked at me and she said, it would be selfish of you to cry for me to stay. So naturally, I cried for her leaving. When my grandma died, my mom and my aunts went through her 13 suitcases. None of her children could afford a house big enough so Grandma could have a room of her own. So everywhere she went, JJ, she carried 13 suitcases from the house of one child to the next. In the 13th suitcase, they were stunned that it was just full of letters.
Wow.
Love letters that my older sister and I had written Grandma all of the years when we were apart. When we lived in Minnesota and she lived in California, this is before long distance calls. So we couldn't afford those. So we used to write her letters, and our objective was to press so hard on the page that our grandma could feel our love, even if she couldn't read the words. They had swept them all up into a pile, and I walked to this pile. I picked up a postcard of a Thai actor that I wanted to marry when I was doing my study abroad in Thailand, and I sent her the postcard for her approval or not. And I flipped it over and I saw that my grandma had read the postcard so many times that the ink had run off, and all you could see was how hard I had pressed onto the page.
Wow.
My first book began, JJ, as a final love letter to my grandma. I was young. I thought that if I wrote everything in my heart out, tell her all of the things that I would never forget, then maybe I would learn how to live life without her. I was on page 37 of this love letter, and my dad, who is a beautiful song poet in the Hmong tradition, he came and he said, what are you doing? And I said, Daddy, I'm writing my final love letter to Grandma. And my father looks at me and he says, if you dream in the right direction, the dreamer never wakes up. The dream never dies. It grows bigger and bigger, Minai. And so a dream was born. I wanted to turn that letter into a book, and it did. It became The Late Homecomer. I followed that with a song poet, a story of my father's life. This man who has fashioned, used his hands to fashion steel, metal, but his heart is the birthplace of poetry in my life. And then more recently, Where Rivers Part, my mother's story. And I should correct you, I'm Hmong American. My family didn't come to America until July 27, 1987, JJ. I was born in the refugee camps of Thailand. Mm. So for the first 6 years of my life, I thought the whole world was a refugee camp. I didn't know how to envision anything different.
Wow.
I saw sometimes people who didn't look Hmong could enter, but we couldn't leave. And it wasn't until my dad climbed the tallest tree in the camp to hold me up so I could see a bigger world, horizons, my father said, that he would never be able to walk, but one day my feet would wander over, that I understood that I had been born in a big cage.
Mm-hmm. The stories you've told in these three books, the beauty that you've injected into them with your writing, with the feeling that's in there, it just jumps off the page. It certainly assaults me from your voice. I mean, and it's a wonderful assault. It's beautiful because it takes me back to that time frame when all these things in the world were going on and my view of what was going on. But now what it does is it transports me to the other side, and I'm looking back at me from your point of view, seeing all the things that are going on here, and from your perspective, and this is just a massively beautiful endeavor. So let me ask you this question. Why did you, this last book, let's start with that. Why did you write this book?
I wanted to write this book for my mother, so that if I got anything wrong, she could correct me. But one thing that I've learned, JJ, especially across the pandemic, which disproportionately impacted my community, there is no guaranteed point of readiness. There is no guarantee on how long we live. I lost many people I loved during the pandemic. My mother did too. And one of them was her older brother's wife. When my mother called my uncle to say, I'm so sorry, my uncle all the way in Laos, my uncle said to her, Jew, if you have anything you want to say to me, say it now when I can hear you. Don't wait until I'm gone. My mother was crying so hard she couldn't say anything. And then my uncle said, oh, I want you to know this. I want you to know that you were the blanket that kept my heart warm after our father died. And those words have stayed with me. The things that I have to say that I want to say about my mother, JJ, I want to say it now when she can still hear me. And so I started writing this book in 2020. And my mother got one of the very first advanced copies of the book.
Yeah.
I translated most of what I could for her. There were parts when it was too emotional for me, too emotional for her, when I said to my mom, mark this page, you have to read it on your own. But my parents, you know, their education in Laos was disrupted by the war. Both my mom and dad's schoolhouses were bombed. Laos is the most heavily bombed nation in the world. Only the world didn't know it, JJ.
Yeah.
And my mom and dad grew up in the most heavily bombed province of Laos. And so in America, as my father would say, they can barely write their own names. I write into English the stories that they wish they could read.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your time in the refugee camp? What was that like?
You know, Thailand was practicing a humane deterrence policy because of all of the wars going on in Southeast Asia at the time. There was Pol Pot in Cambodia. There was a Vietnam War that we all know about. There's a secret war in Laos, among so many other things happening. And Thailand didn't want any more Hmong refugees. So they were giving Hmong people food rations 3 days a week. And we were expected to wait out the rest of the week. In Ban Binai refugee camp where I was born, suicide was the number one cause of death, JJ. All I need to do is close my eyes and I can hear the drums of the dead beating. People crying, men and women, why are you dying here? Why are you dying in this place that does not want you? Get up so we can go home. I remember asking everybody in my life, if this is not home, then where is home? And my grandmother would tell me it was the high mountains of Laos when a kid could kick the belly of the clouds. For my mom and dad, it was some imagined future, perhaps across a wide ocean, where their daughters could become educated people. My mother had 6 miscarriages after me, JJ, in the camp. Every time I looked at her, she gave me the food that was in her hand, the food that was in her mouth. And so the wind blew into her, and these baby boys, all of them big enough so the adults could tell that they were baby boys, couldn't come down to life with us. So I was their baby. My older sister, Dove, who had contracted polio as a baby in that camp, and me, we were their babies. The most important thing that they said they had. And although they were young, in terms of age, they had lived lifetimes already by the time I entered.
I don't know that I was prepared for this interview. I did some reading and did some thinking. But I had no idea that it would be as emotional as this. And it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And I want to thank you for doing that. That's in part what Colors is all about, is people's stories. You're in St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota now. How's your life been in the U.S. and there specifically?
I was 6 and a half when my family came to America, July 27, 1987. You know, when you leave a country, when you are refugees, sometimes you're given gifts for leaving a country. And so we were all given thick sweaters for America. And I remember my mom and dad had dressed me in this navy blue sweater, pants, socks, But America, Minnesota, July 27 was incredibly hot, JJ. My first understanding of this new world was that suddenly, even my mom and dad, they couldn't prepare any of us for what was to come. I was tested to see where I would be placed in school, and I remember this white woman in a red reindeer sweater, and I'd never seen a reindeer before,
Wow.
looking down at me and saying, "Say your ABCs." And I'd never been to school, so I naturally said A, B, and C. And she shakes her head and she says, "Say the whole thing." And again, I repeat A, B, and C. Regardless, they had to put me in the first grade. And so I was in the first grade. My sister was placed in the second grade. But we were in a TESOL classroom. And so we were with all of these kids, some older. I was among the youngest, and we were all in one classroom because the St. Paul Public Schools was not that they were not ready for us.
Right.
This influx of refugees. Nobody knew who the Hmong were. I mean, you knew about the Vietnamese because of the Vietnam War, but we come from a secret war. And so nobody knew who we were or what we were doing here. And across the spaces of my life, even here in St. Paul, Minneapolis, the biggest concentration of Hmong people in the country. We don't have the highest population. California has the highest population, and Minnesota second, Wisconsin third, North Carolina fourth. But here, in those early years, the question was always, what are you people doing here in America? And I remember one time being in a gas station with my dad, and here my dad couldn't earn a living with his poetry. He had to earn a living with his hands. So my father as a machinist has incredibly rough hands, JJ. When human flesh cuts into metal, it suffers. And they've grown arthritic with the years. And I remember one time dad was holding coins and he dropped them on the ground. And so I was helping him pick them up. But this big white guy behind us, he spat on the ground and he said, "What are you people doing here? You're doing nothing but slowing us down." And I couldn't say anything. I was a teenager. I couldn't say anything. And my dad, we both just scrambled as quickly as we could to pick up those coins. And in the car, JJ, as he's driving, I can see my father has a single teardrop and it's falling down his face. And he looks at me and he says, "I've given America all of you. What more do I have to give? What more do I have to give?"
Wow.
Can't say that it was easy growing up in the Midwest as a Hmong American family, low income. I come from the east side of St. Paul. It is the most diverse part of the city, but also the most economically disadvantaged part of the city. And I'm proud to say that I still live on the east side of St. Paul, that I've come back as a little girl, watching, the empty bottles roll down the sidewalks, all of the houses with their sloped porches, the paint peeling. I used to think, one day, if I become educated, if I get a college degree, I'm going to move everybody away from here. But of course, that's not how life works.
Yeah.
We return to the places that make us who we are. And so I moved back to the east side of St. Paul to raise my own family.
There's a heck of a lot of symbolism here where the rivers part. Where you live, there's a big river that runs through Minnesota, the Mississippi River. I wonder if that huge river, which runs through the United States all the way through, says anything to you.
So, in order to understand my relationship to the Mississippi, you have to first understand that my family and thousands of other Hmong families, we had to cross the Mekong River to get into Thailand.
Right.
In the Mekong River, I mean, it's so many Hmong people died, JJ. They never made it. They entered on one side and they never exited on the other. My family is one of the lucky ones that survived. But in the place where I was born, there were no rivers. We were in northeastern Thailand, the poorest part of Thailand. That's where they put the refugee camps. And all I knew was a river of sewage, an open sewer system. I thought that was a river, JJ. It wasn't until I saw the Great Mississippi that I realized, wait, what was that thing that we crossed over to get from one side to the other? And then to understand the title of the book, we have to understand that my mother was born in a village called Dai Chua, where rivers come together. She was born in an island village. And she's journeyed far away from that village now, but right here we live by Bidote, sacred territory for the native populations here, where the Minnesota and the Mississippi come together, this confluence of rivers. In thinking about my mother's story, I thought about how far she traveled from one place to get to the other, all of the rivers that she's crossed, but also not only where rivers meet, but where rivers part. Her own journey with her mother. My mother was 16 years old, JJ, when she met my father. There was a contingent of 10,000 soldiers chasing after the Hmong for having helped the Americans in the war. One night, my mother chooses to run with my father, afraid that she'll never see him again. That run leads them into marriage. And JJ, they visit a few more times. But on one of those occasions, my mother thought there would be a tomorrow. And so she walks away with my father in the middle of the jungle, and she never sees her mother again. 16 years of love had to last a lifetime, JJ. My grandmother died in Laos eventually. It wasn't until 2018 that my older sister and I could take our parents back to Laos, where that my mother could be reunited with her mother. And that was one of the most heartbreaking experiences of my life. Growing up, my mother used to say that one day, if she were ever to meet her mother again, she would tell her everything. Everything that has happened since she left her mother behind in that jungle. The 7 kids that died, those 7 miscarriages, the 7 that lived, my brothers and sisters and I. But JJ, when my mother was there next to the grave mound of the grandmother I never met, the only thing that came out were cries, and they were not cries of a woman. They were the cries of a girl, a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to call the book Where Rivers Part to honor all of that, the legacy of the women that I come from, women who were not born with luck on their side, who have had to survive despite that fact.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important to share before we go?
I think it would be irresponsible of me not to address the fact, JJ, that we live in a world teeming with wars, a world creating refugees by the second. As a refugee child myself, you know, and my father reminds me in his poet's way that I was not a child of poverty or despair or hopelessness, but that I was in fact hope being born the captain to a more beautiful future. As this writer that I am today, I think about all of the stories that are cut short, all of the stories that are growing from this moment that we live in. And I am astounded by all that is to come, astounded by all that is happening right here, right now. But I also want to say to all of your listeners, for everything that we are, America is still a beacon of light for so many refugees that we said we resettle more refugees than any other nation in the world. And I think that is a fact that is incredibly important to our identity as Americans, but also our commitment to each other's humanity for all the travesties.
I could spend all day and it still wouldn't be enough time. But I want to say just humbly, thank you. You know, you're a healer. You are absolutely a healer. Your words are healers. Your words are the words of a healer. Thank you. I appreciate this and I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, JJ. Thank you for reading a little snippet about a writer and then finding her in the world and saying, come talk to me.
Stay tuned for some thoughts about race in America and details about our next guest.
You're listening to Colors.
My name is Jesselyn. I'm a multiracial woman raised primarily by white people. I live in Oakland, California, and the killing of George Floyd was heartbreaking and also infuriating, not only because it's a gross abuse of power and violence again, but because our community members have been surviving and grieving and witnessing and calling out this injustice for literally hundreds of years.
This is Colors, a dialogue on race in America.
If you have any questions or comments about Colors, send us an email. You can reach us at colors@thecolorspodcast.com. That's colors@thecolorspodcast.com.
Coming up in our next episode of Colors.
Tracy Scott is a woman of many talents. She worked on The Hill, she was a journalist for network television, and she spent some time in a war zone during the Iraq War. And she's written a very unique book.
I was trying to go through gas mask training, and I had my earrings on. I always wear hoop earrings. And I tried to put on my gas mask, and my friend looked over at me, and she's like, Tracy, you can't put on your gas mask without first taking off your hoop earrings.
That is actually the title of the book, but it's not a joke. It's a real-life guide to life. The subtitle is A Civilian Chick's Guide to Surviving a War Zone.
That's coming up in our next episode of Colors.
That's it for another edition of Colors. Thank you to Hillary Howard. Thanks, Ernie Green, Ron Pemberton, Angelique Chong. And thanks for all our music to Jesse Gallagher. Thanks to Akash Gandhi. Thanks to Offshane. And I'd like to say thank you to you for bringing along other people to check out the program. I really appreciate it. And as always, please continue to talk to each other.
And just as important, keep listening to each other.
You can subscribe to Colors wherever you get your podcasts. This is Colors, a dialogue on race in America.